This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. What would you do with your life if you didn't have to worry about earning a salary and your most basic needs were met? Well, that's a question that only the independently wealthy in our country have the luxury of contemplating. You might become an artist, a writer, a tech innovator, a chef. The possibilities are endless. But of course, you can't imagine such things. You and I have to worry about where we get our health insurance, how we might juggle two jobs to make ends meet, how we're going to pay for childcare or rent. A vast majority of Americans are stuck working in an economy that's not working for them. One where jobs are part-time, pay is dismal, the so-called gig economy is ever dominant, and unionization is stagnant. Well, Andy Stern, the former president of one of the nation's strongest unions, SEIU, has offered the idea of a universal basic income as a solution to our rapidly transforming economy. Citing the increasing replacement of human workers with an automated workforce, Stern, in a new book, has made a strong case for why we need a universal basic income now more than ever. In addition to being the former president of SEIU, Andy Stern served on the Simpson-Bowles Commission. He's currently the Ronald O. Perelman Senior Fellow at Columbia University's Richard Paul Richmond Center for Business, Law, and Public Policy, and he joins me to discuss his new book, Raising the Floor, How a Universal Basic Income Can Renew Our Economy and Rebuild the American Dream. Welcome to our show, Andy.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, as I said, the idea that one might have our basic needs met by government is a luxury, or just have our basic needs met in general is a luxury that only the wealthy currently have. And increasingly, even those of us who are very happy earning an income, very happy simply, you know, being paid for the work we do, are having a harder and harder time finding the right work and finding work that pays enough. And now being, not just now, but really over the last 10 years, being replaced by automated workers. Can you tell us what led you down this journey of contemplating something that, maybe most ordinary Americans might dismiss as being way too socialist as a universal basic income? What started your journey down this path?
Well, first of all, I would say there's obviously an irony that if you had asked me that question about universal basic income 2 years ago, I really wouldn't have known what it was. I spent my whole life in one job, which was working for a union, being a member of a union, and for the last 14 years being the president of a union who spent every day trying to change the lives of childcare and home care, janitors, security officers, food service workers, people that, as you said, work very hard, but increasingly were having a hard time making their ends meet. And so, after passing health care, which was an extraordinary accomplishment, in particular that it increased coverage for another 15 to 20 million people, and having watched all the great things that SEIU had done, I realized that we lived in a world where poverty was still growing, where inequality was increasing, and where growth in the economy was no longer producing the kind of changes that we had hoped for people that work. And so I needed new answers, and I really didn't have any. So I began this journey, which I write about in my book, to try to understand what was really going on in the economy that no longer made hard work or unions or the kind of things that got you ahead in the past, like a college degree, work anymore.
And you found that one of the main things was that workers are simply being replaced by non-humans. I mean, this sounds a little too futuristic, this idea that we're going to have a robot workforce do all of the sort of grunt work for us. But how much in the future is it, and how much of it is already here?
Well, so what's already here is software. And if you think about what we now call just-in-time production, that's all facilitated by the fact that we have software that can allow a factory to only make the things it needs in terms of it's able to sell, for warehouses to only house the products it needs to use in a very limited period of time. Or you take a office where you used to have a lot of people who are administrative assistants or secretaries, now being replaced by technology and smartphones and email and other things that are fueled by software, or globalization, which is really fueled by software. Right now, the pressure, downward pressure on jobs and wages is caused by software. What we're going to see, and what you talked about, is what happens when automation, artificial intelligence, 3D printing, nanotechnology begin to take hold. And I would say we're going to understand that problem when we see what happens with truck driving. Now, truck driving is the largest job in 29 states. 3.5 million people drive a truck every day. There are 6.8 million people in insurance, auto repair, rest stops, parts, emergency rooms, ticket giving that are supporting the truck drivers. And all of a sudden, those jobs are potentially going to be eliminated. And the technology already exists. It's just the regulatory environment isn't quite there. So, you know, we are seeing now, as I like to say, the first part of the Uber economy, where you can do things like provide universal benefits or portable benefits or many of the things Elizabeth Warren talks about. But what happens when the next phase of Uber comes and there are no drivers? And that is what we need to prepare ourselves for.
Yeah, I mean, we're at a point where, you know, telemarketers and customer service, those are all essentially now automated, and it's software piecing together the voice of once humans. And more those jobs that used to be done by humans that people could actually earn a decent income on once upon a time are rapidly disappearing. And whenever we hear politicians address this issue, Andy, the solution that we hear from them is more investment in college education, worker training, pushing people towards the so-called STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Why is that not the solution?
So I think what we're already seeing is those kinds of solutions, STEM, which the RAND Corporation says is not a desperate need that many people want to promote as the answer to the future. Coding is not the same desperate need that people want to promote. The Economic Policy Institute has said that college education is no longer a guarantee of getting more wage increases, and so many college-educated graduates are underemployed. Even if they're not unemployed, they've taken the jobs at Starbucks or in restaurants that many high school graduates used to have before. So we've already seen that those jobs and those mitigating policies are not enough, and that's before we have this tsunami of disruption that's caused by technology in the next phase of change, when accountants and finance and lawyers and doctors and healthcare professionals all will feel the change that comes about through technological innovation. So it's only accelerating. What we're doing now isn't enough, and it's certainly going to be insufficient in the future.
So isn't technology, though, something that has both upsides and downsides? I mean, on the one hand, if technology can take over jobs that were considered onerous, that were even considered sort of a mind-numbing, you know, not very intellectually challenging, that maybe that is a good thing. I mean, isn't there a good side and a bad side to technology?
Yeah, I'm a pro-technology person. I'm not interested in trying to imagine stopping change. I tried that a lot in the labor movement. It's a very wonderful idea. It just doesn't work very well. Change is inevitable. It's progress that's optional. So the question for me then, as you've raised, is what would make this society where there's access to all kinds of information everywhere in the world, where there's all kinds of labor-saving devices work? And I think there are two questions which my book asks people to debate, which is, how do people survive economically on one hand? And then what is life about, you know, if we have an abundance that's created by technology and we can find a way to distribute it more fairly, what do people do with their time? And I think that's both a philosophical question, or as Maslow said, if we could move up the needs hierarchy more towards self-fulfillment or self-actualization, wouldn't we want to do that as a society? And I think those are enormously important discussions that old people like me, who are lived through the one job in a lifetime, college gets you everywhere career, are probably not in the best place to lead that discussion. That really belongs to the next generation of leaders and people entering the workforce.
Now, what about the tremendous success, however, that the Fight for 15 campaign and other workers' campaigns have had around the country, where in pushing from the grassroots for higher wages, even if it's some of the results are not immediate, within the next few years, we might start to see some measure of money flow downwards into the pockets of ordinary people. Even the, you know, even Walmart has kind of seen the writing on the wall. Isn't that something that can be a more realistic panacea for the current state of the economy?
Well, first of all, I think those are extraordinary accomplishments. And you know, I'm so proud of my union's leaders who really led that campaign. And I call these mitigating policies. These are all good things for the next 5 or 10 years. But we already can see, how do you pay an Amazon Turk worker, an Amazon person who is an independent contractor driving a truck or an Uber driver, what does $15 an hour mean to them? What does it mean to the freelance journalist? Now, how do you calculate those things? So it is fabulous that that's happening. It's going to change, you know, 20 to 50 million workers' lives, and I'm all for it. But the world is about to take another shift. And what I'm more worried about is not how do we help the Uber driver today, but how do we deal in a world where there's driverless trucks and driverless cars tomorrow?
You wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal some years ago where you basically cited China's model, and you discussed what Intel founder Andy Grove had been writing about. Tell us how we can put this idea of rapidly changing U.S. economy into a broader global framework. I mean, it's not just in the U.S. where these changes are happening, where even fighting for higher wages is just a short-term goal.
Well, first of all, part of the article was to say the quite obvious that the market economy of the 20th century, you know, which worked a lot better, is not working at all for the 21st century, as for the last 20 years, American workers haven't gotten a wage increase. So first of all, it's just saying, forget this idea that if we can only deregulate or let the market work, that we will solve our problems. That is completely discredited right now, and we need to start from there. The second thing I said is whether you're a company or a country, you need a plan. And for a country, the plan has to be, how are the people that are responsible to make decisions for the country going to ensure that there's economic security and economic stability for everyone? You know, China had its model of state capitalism. You know, the Scandinavian countries have a more democratic socialism or a more social benefited base for security and stability for people. What's the American plan if it's not the market? And so what I wrote about is trying to make a plan that tries to be successful, not where the world is, but where it's going to be. And I think that's one of the reasons I wrote the art book about universal basic income, because I actually think it's an idea that can work in the future, you know, even far better than it may work today, because there are policies like $15 and universal health care that I think can solve some of today's or ameliorate some of today's problems.
Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty of it. There have been countries around the world that have flirted with the idea of it and are actively considering it. Switzerland had a referendum on a universal basic income. Britain is thinking about it. And once upon a time, the United States also considered it under, of all people, President Richard Nixon. How politically realistic is the idea of a universal basic income in the United States, given that there are countries even today that are kind of, you know, flirting with this idea?
Well, we should appreciate, and you referenced it, that the United States is the country that came closest anywhere in the world of implementing a universal basic income. It was an idea promoted by a conservative icon, Milton Friedman, adopted by a Republican president that passed a Republican House. It would have provided every American a guarantee of $10,000 a year. And it was only defeated in the U.S. Senate by Democrats because they thought it wasn't enough.
Oh, my goodness. Really?
After the next election, they thought, okay, we'll get it up a little bit higher where it belongs, which obviously never happened. And what was interesting is 1,200 economists, left and right, progressive, conservative, John Kenneth Galbraith, and others, wrote a public letter supporting a universal basic income. So we became really close to getting there. And what we failed at, which is what Martin Luther King wrote about in his last book, From Chaos to Community, is he said, the civil rights movement wanted to end poverty. We didn't ask for all these different programs for housing and food stamps and unemployment and welfare. We wanted you to end poverty. And if you want to end poverty, give people money. And that was the theory of time from the left, you know, and the right. And what I think is makes this politically possible is that in Finland, they're doing an experiment for 8,000 people. It's being done by a center-right government. Justin Trudeau, a very kind of, you know, moderate, progressive government, is flirting with
in
the
Canada.
Idea of doing an experiment in Canada, in Ontario, in Quebec. We see it in Namibia. We see it in London or UK, as you said. Utrecht is going to change its welfare system. So all of a sudden, both progressives and conservatives are saying, our anti-poverty programs have failed us. Almost half the children in America live in poverty. We need to try something new, and the thing we should do is just give people money.
You know, this kind of reminds me of the debate over the Affordable Care Act and, you know, having insurance companies be regulated versus single-payer healthcare, you know, taking out the middleman, taking out the complexity, the patchwork system, and replacing it with an elegant, simple system that can actually work. So how would this work? So currently we've got things like Social Security, Medicare that only, you know, some, well, Medicare is only, some people are eligible for. Social Security we all pay into, but we don't reap till we reach retirement age. And then depending upon your income level, you may be eligible, and where you live, which state you live, you may be eligible for any number of, usually very hard to apply for, and very, very modest amounts of welfare, generally reserved for the poorest in the country. And even those are being politically attacked by Republicans, not championed hard enough by Democrats. Would your idea do away with this, with many of these programs, and simply replace it with what, an annual or a monthly check to taxpayers?
So what I write about in the book is, number one, I don't think healthcare is anything that can be managed by individuals or the private sector. And I think what Bernie Sanders talked about, a Medicare for all, or some version of what we see around the world that provides better results for less costs, make a lot more sense. So I don't believe that a universal basic income is really the way we should give everyone a guarantee of healthcare in this country. And I also believe that people that have invested to date in Social Security, you know, should not have their Social Security cashed out unilaterally, that we should let people that have contributed continue to receive it. If it doesn't provide them, you know, the amount that I'm proposing, $1,000 a month, we should top up their Social Security, but I don't.
So they can be sort of a phasing out period.
I think people who are entering the workforce is a whole different question, who've never paid in, whether they'd be better off getting $1,000 a month for the rest of their life, using the money now that is put into Social Security for a personal savings account or an account managed by someone like Tia Kreff or other nonprofits is a better idea. That's a very healthy debate, but not for people that have made the contributions today. The last thing I'd say is whatever we do, we shouldn't hurt poor people. So we should not design a system, which a lot of conservatives might do, that leaves people worse off. So having said that, my proposal is simple. We cash out some of the 122 welfare programs that currently exist, that we add more money in through other revenue sources I write about, and that we give every adult 18 to 64 $1,000 a month. That's $12,000 a year above the official poverty line. Unfortunately, it's not enough that people can choose not to work, but it's really a supplement to work, and that we top up the people, as I said, over 64 so they don't suffer because they're in the Social Security system. And we, I would say, at least statistically end poverty. I'd hate to say that $12,000 an adult ends poverty. We decide what other programs we want to continue to make available. Obviously, people with disabilities or other kinds of enormous needs, or people who live in high-cost housing areas, there may be other kinds of programs to supplement it, but the floor, what you could guarantee yourself every adult day of your life is getting a check every month, just like they get a check once a year in Alaska. You know, that is your basic income, your dividend, your share, your stake, you know, in the American dream.
I'm speaking with Andy Stern, former president of the SEIU, and he served on the Simpson-Bowles Commission. He's currently the Ronald O. Perelman Senior Fellow at Columbia University's Richard Paul Richmond Center for Business Law and Public Policy. We're discussing his new book, Raising the Floor, How a Universal Basic Income Can Renew Our Economy and Rebuild the American Dream. We're going to keep Andy Stern on for an extended interview as we continue this conversation, and you can access that extended interview in the on-demand channel section of our website, risingupwithsonali.com. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.